Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at Vanderbilt's Blair School of Music.
Hi, guys. I met Ann Patchett when I was a wee thing of 19. Since then, in the style of a fairy godmother slash best friend slash mom, she's been advising me on all matter of life. So when I called her almost 4 years ago, crying and hating my life in New York City, and told her I wanted to move to Nashville, first she told me no, and then when I insisted it was the right move for me, she told me I could work for her until I found a job. Now, it turns out that Anne doesn't exactly need a full-time personal assistant. So once we'd done everything I thought needed to be done, like signing her up for online bill pay and managing her iTunes library, and everything she thought needed to be done, like forcing me to the gym every day and trying unsuccessfully to teach me how to cook, we were left with a lot of time on our hands. It turns out that before this moment in our lives, Anne would just rip the articles that she'd written out of magazines or newspapers and toss them into a giant box in the back of her closet without so much as glancing at them. And this box was basically the only place some of these pieces still existed. So I invented the project of scanning them all and making a digital library of her work. As I was scanning, I was reading, and I had a realization. It turns out Anne's a pretty darn good writer. Now, I know Anne pretty well, but reading these pieces gave me insight into her life, both as a writer and as a person, that I'd never known. So I made two stacks. Articles that could go back into the box in the back of her closet, like How to Choose a Cake Topper That Resembles You and Your Fiancé from Bridal Guide magazine, and articles that simply had to become part of a book, like The Sacrament of Divorce. And once I had what I thought was enough evidence to convince her, I trotted downstairs and made my case for why she simply had to do a book of essays. It's with complete excitement, joy, and delight that tonight I can introduce to you that book and its author, my beloved friend, Anne Patchett.
That was the largest collection of really nice introductions that I have ever had in my life. Also, what was really funny about that is I didn't know what Nikki was going to say, and now she's gone. And that was the story that I was going to start off this evening telling you. So now I'm thinking, well, I could tell you how I told her how to roast a chicken. I would like to say thank you before I get too far away from all of this to Connie Hurd and Edgar Meyer, who had us over to their house for dinner a while ago. And at that dinner party, I met Mark Waite, and that's why we're all here tonight in this beautiful auditorium. So I'm just thrilled that Blair has invited us to host a salon event here. Nikki is entirely responsible for this book, and I'm going to just elaborate on this story a little bit more. When she gave me the collection of essays, the book that she put together, not only did I not want to do it, but I couldn't read it. One of my psychological problems, and I have a lot of them, is that I can't read my work again after I've finished it. I've never read any of my novels. Most people that I know have never read any of their novels. But when you get to the end of a book, you've read it so many times. You've just gone through it. You've done the copy editing and the proofreading and the page proofs, and it's dead. I just never, ever want to see it again. So to take an entire group of articles that I had written over such a long period of time and try to read them again really froze me. When I would start to read them, I realized something about my own psychology that I never really knew before, which is all of my life, I have been taking events that I didn't know what to do with and writing them down and sticking them away. And by sticking them away, I mean like in the Atlantic. Just thinking, okay, I don't want to carry this around. I wonder what other people do with the events of their lives, because we can't really hold them all. But to be able to put them in a magazine and then really kind of close the door on it and forget it is how psychologically I've processed things, that things that are good, things that are bad, it doesn't really make any difference. They're just things that are over. And so it took me a really long time, and Nikki constantly harping at me, have you read the book? Have you read the book? Have you? To be able to read the book. That was the worst part of it all. And that took months. And when I read it, I immediately thought, no, there's no way I am going to put this book out. And I said this when I was doing an interview last week. The person said, well, what difference does it make? I mean, these pieces were all published before. Why would it bother you now? And I said, it's like if you wear a dress that's sleeveless and somebody takes your picture, and then you wear a dress that's kind of short, but it has a high neck and long sleeves, and somebody takes your picture. And then you wear a dress that's kind of low cut. And then you wear a dress without a back. And then at each time somebody takes your picture, and then you put all of those pictures together, you're naked. It's like one at a time, it's fine. But if you link them up, it becomes this excruciating amount of information. And what I did when I started reading it is I went through and looked for what I started to think of as the weak sister. I would read through the book and I would think, what's the worst essay in the book? And the first time, that was like half the book. And so then I knew that I couldn't do it. And at the same time, I got some offers to write some really, really long essays. And so all of a sudden I started thinking, well, you know, if this was going to be a book, then I would want to write an essay about writing. Then I would want to write a really long piece about marriage. Then I would want to write a really long piece about my father and the fact that I once tried out for the Los Angeles Police Department. That in itself is reason enough to get this book. It explains in this book how to jump over a 6-foot wall, which is something that I learned how to do when I was trying out for the police department when I was much younger. And anyway, so I kept putting them together, and I still, for the reasons of the nakedness and the pictures and the connectivity of the whole thing, I still couldn't imagine putting it out. And what happened was the thing that really changed everything in my life, which was I met Karen Hayes, and we decided to open Parnassus Books. And that happened, we made that decision, and I'm going to read you an essay about this in a second, right as I was getting ready to go on book tour for State of Wonder. And there was this huge shift in my life where I went from somebody who was, I think of the best way to say it is, I went from being an indoor person. I mean, I went from somebody who was really always trying to stay inside and quiet and small and do my work and have kind of minimal interface with the community, to being somebody who was in every way an outdoor person. I was out there. I was forever standing on top of something and making a speech and talking about book selling and talking about small business owners and being interviewed all the time. And everything changed. And suddenly I felt like everyone knew who I was. Everyone knew what I was doing. And I, all this time, I'm working on the essays. I'm writing new essays. I'm trying to make it into a shape. Trying to make it into kind of a novel in a way, kind of an arc of stories and not just loose things I had lying around that I'm all going to stick in there together. It didn't matter anymore because life was so public that I really did think, well, you know what? What difference does it make? I'm going to go ahead and publish these essays. And that also led to a change, which is I feel like in my life I've tried so hard not to be an embarrassment to my family or to anybody, seriously. You know, that you could read my books and not know anything about me, anything about the people in my life. Nobody is going to walk around talking about my family because of my novels. Although, if any of you knew Jean Puryear, God bless Jean Puryear. I used to live in an apartment building with her, the Helena Court, out on Belmead Boulevard, and she said to one of the other women living in the apartment building after she read Patron Saint of Liars, well, if you ask me, that girl knows a little bit too much about homes for unwed mothers. So, nothing is safe. But it's just interesting to grow up, and that's what I'm doing here in front of you a month before my 50th birthday. I am growing up and thinking, you know, maybe nothing's off limits. Maybe it's time to kind of own my whole life and write about whatever I feel like writing about. And a lot of that impetus has come into this book. I heard Philip Glass say once in an interview that you should never go to a symphony on opening night, that you should wait until the symphony has been played for, say, 20 years or something, if you really want to hear it done right. That if you hear it early, it's not more exciting, it's just worse. And that said, I'm going to read for the first time from this book now. You know, I've been doing this for novels for so long, and trying to cut a reading and make it work, get the right shape. You know, it's a drag. And now I have this book of essays, and I'm thinking, I can read any of these. They're all the right shape. This is all going to work. And I sat down, and I started reading them and timing them and trying to figure out. And I would say, oh, that one's too personal. That one's too depressing. That one sounds like I'm pontificating. This is something that you may have heard, and it is trimmed down. It's called The Bookstore Strikes Back, and Parnassus is going to be 2 years old on November 16th, and I am not going to be here. I am going to be on book tour, but given the fact that we're two and all of these things happened a scant 2 years ago, can you believe it? Doesn't it just feel like, you know, we're like the donut den? We're just right there. Yeah, donuts. All right. In late February of 2012, I am in my basement, which is really a very nice part of my house that is not done justice by the word basement. For purposes of this story, let's call it the Parnassus Fulfillment Center. I have hauled 533 boxed-up hardback copies of my latest novel, State of Wonder, from Parnassus, the bookstore I co-own in Nashville, into my car, driven them across town, three trips there, three trips back, and then lugged them down here to the Parnassus Fulfillment Center. Along with the hardbacks, I've brought in countless paperback copies of my backlist books as well. I sign these books, I stack them up on one enormous and extremely sturdy table, and then I call for backup. Nikki and Patrick from the store, my friend Judy, my mother, together we form an assembly line, taking the orders off the bookstore's website, addressing mailing labels, writing tiny thank you notes to tuck into the signed copies, then bubble wrapping, taping, and packing them up to mail. You have no idea. This is like, just reading that sentence, it's like I was chipping things into stone. We so didn't know what we were doing. Bubble wrap, seriously? We got a rhythm going. We had a system. It's pretty smooth, except for removing the orders from the website. What I don't understand is that no matter how many orders I delete from the list does not get smaller. We are all work and no progress, and I'm sure that something is going seriously wrong. After all, we've had this website for a week, and who's to say that we know what we're doing? We know what we're doing, Nikki says, and Patrick, who set up the website in the first place, confirms this. They explain to me that the reason the list isn't getting any shorter is that the orders are still coming in. You may have heard the news that independent bookstores are dead, that books are dead, that maybe even reading is dead, to which I say, pull up a chair, friend. I have a story to tell. The reason I am signing and wrapping books in my basement is that more orders have come in than the store can handle, and the reason that the orders have come in is that a few days before, I had been a guest on the Colbert Report. After a healthy round of jostling about bookstores versus Amazon, Mr. Colbert held up a copy of my novel in front of the cameras and exhorted America to buy it from Amazon. To which I, without a moment's thought, because without a moment's thought is pretty much how I fly these days, shouted, no, 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 not Amazon. Order it off ParnassusBooks.net, and I'll sign it for you. And America took me up on my offer. That explains how I got caught in the basement, but fails to answer the larger question. What was a writer of literary fiction whose new book was already 10 months old doing on Colbert in the first place? Hang on, because this is where things start to get weird. I was on the show not because I am a writer, but because I am a famous independent bookseller. Let's go back to the beginning of the story. A year before, the city of Nashville had two bookstores. One was Davis Kidd, which had been our much-beloved, locally-owned and operated independent before selling out to the Ohio-based chain Joseph Beth Booksellers 10 years before. Joseph Beth moved Davis Kidd into the mall. God, I hated that store in the mall. Provided it with 30,000 square feet of retail space and put wind chimes and coffee mugs and scented candles in front of the books. We continued to call it our local independent, even though we knew it wasn't really true anymore. Nashville also had a Borders, which was about the same size as the Davis Kidd, that sat on the edge of Vanderbilt's campus. In December of 2010, Davis Kidd closed. It had been profitable, declared the owners from Ohio, who were dismantling the chain, just not profitable enough. Then, in March 2011, the Borders store, also profitable, went the way of all Borders store. We woke up one morning, and we didn't have a bookstore. How had this happened? Had digital books led us astray? Had we been lured away by the siren song of Amazon's undercut pricing? Had we been careless, failed to support the very places that had hosted our children's story hours and brought in touring authors and set up summer reading tables? Our city experienced a great collective gnashing of teeth and rending of garments, but to what extent was Nashville to blame? Both of the stores that closed had been profitable. Despite the fact that our two bookstores were the size of department stores and bore enormous rents, they had been making their numbers every month. Nashvillians, I would like the record to show, had been buying books. What I did not much miss in those mall-size gargantuas, the store I really missed had been gone much longer than that. Mills was the bookstore of my youth. This isn't going to be nearly as much fun to read other places. Nobody's going to make that soft little moaning sound when I say Mills. My sister and I used to walk there every day after school, stopping first to check out the puppies at Jones' pet store across the street. Aww. Thank you. We're all going to be sobbing pretty soon. And then going to admire the glossy covers of the Christian Lavensdatter series, which is what girls read after they had finished the Little House on the Prairie books back before the Twilight books had been written. Mills could not have been more than 700 square feet small, and the people who worked there, Stephanie Freudenthal, remembered who you were and what you had read even if you were 10. If I could have that kind of bookstore, one that valued books and readings above muffins and adorable plastic watering cans, a store that recognized it could not possibly stock every single book that every single person was looking for, and so stock the books that the staff had read and liked and could recommend. If I could recreate the bookish happiness of my childhood, then maybe I was the person for the job. Or maybe not. I wanted to go into retail about as much as I wanted to go into the army. You're like a really good cook who thinks she should open a restaurant, my friend Steve Turner told me over dinner. I'd gone to Steve for advice because he has a particular knack for starting businesses, which had led to his particular knack for making money. He was trying to talk me down from the ledge. And anyway, you already have a job. I wasn't thinking of working in the bookstore, I said. He shook his head. Don't ever think you can start a business and just turn it over to someone else. It never works. In truth, I left that dinner feeling relieved. I had been to the Oracle, and the Oracle had told me that mine was a bad idea, which must have been what I wanted to hear. In fact, it was exactly Steve Turner's words that I was thinking of when I met Karen Hayes the next week. We were introduced by our one friend in common, Mary Gray James. Karen was then a sales rep for Random House, as Mary Gray had been my sales rep back at Harcourt. They had both worked at Ingram, a large book distributor outside of Nashville. Karen, who is tall and pale and serious in a way that brings to mind pilgrims and homesteaders and other indefatigably hard-working people, meant to open a bookstore. Her plan was to quit her job and devote her life to the project. All she lacked was the money. I suggested, never having considered investing in the book business and not having been asked to do so, that I could pay for the store and promote it. Karen and I would be the co-owners, and Mary Gray would be the store's general manager, thus solving the problem of how I could have a bookstore without actually having to work in a bookstore. We hammered out a tentative plan in the time it took to eat a sandwich. Then Karen pulled a prospectus out of her bag and handed it to me. "It's called Parnassus Books," she said. I looked at the word, which struck me as hard to spell and harder to remember. I shook my head. I don't like it. How many people would know what it meant? Oh, in Greek mythology, Mount Parnassus is the home of literature, learning, music, dance, and some other important things. I had wanted a store called Independent People after the great Halldór Laxness novel about Iceland and sheep. Or perhaps Redbird Books, because I believe that simple titles, especially those containing colors, are memorable. I've always wanted a bookstore called Parnassus, Karen said. I looked at this woman I didn't know, my potential business partner. I wanted a bookstore in Nashville. Why should I get to name it? You're the one who's got to work there, I said. That night, after talking it over with my husband and then securing a more detailed character reference from Mary Gray, I called Karen. According to her numbers, $300,000 would be needed to open the then 2,500-square-foot bookstore. I told her I was in. This was April 30th, 2011. In 2 weeks, I was to leave for the UK leg of the State of Wonder tour. The US leg of the tour started June 7th. Karen would be working for Random House until June 10th. "Should I announce this on book tour?" I asked. I knew that I'd be giving interviews all day long during the entire month of June. Should I tell people what we had planned over lunch? That we had a name I didn't like, but money in the bank? That we were strangers? Sure, Karen said after some real hesitation. I guess. I look back on all this now, and I am dizzied by the blitheness that stood in place for any sort of business sense. The grand gesture of walking over to the roulette table and betting it all on a single number. Anyone I mentioned this plan to was quick to remind me that books were dead, and in 2 years, I have no idea where 2 years came from, but it was the figure that everyone threw at me, in 2 years, books would no longer exist, much less bookstores, and that I might as well be selling 8-track tapes and typewriters. But somehow all the naysaying never lodged itself in my brain. I could see it working as clearly as I could see me standing beside my sister at Mills. I was a writer, after all, and my book sold pretty well. I spoke to crowds of enthusiastic readers all over the country, and those readers were my proof. More than that, I was partnering with Karen Hayes, who wore the steely determination of a woman who could clear a field and plant it by herself, and with Mary Gray, my dear friend, who had opened a bookstore before. Moreover, our two giant departed bookstores had been profitable every month. There was the roulette ball bouncing up again and again until it finally came to rest on the number I had chosen. So, without a location or anything like an opening date, I left for my book tour, and on the first day, I announced on the Diane Rehm Show that, along with my partner Karen Hayes, I would be opening an independent bookstore in Nashville. I was vague on every detail, but when asked about the name, I managed to say the word Parnassus. While I was flying from city to city, Karen was driving around the South in a U-Haul, buying up shelving at rock-bottom prices from various border stores that were liquidating. Amazing. I had written, you know, I'll just stop there. I often say that if our roles had been first, if I had been building the store and Karen had been bankrolling it, I would have just called Thomas Mosier to come down and build in floor-to-ceiling cherry bookshelves. I had written one check before I left for $150,000, and I kept asking her if she needed more money. No, she didn't need more money. At the end of the summer, Karen and I finally settled on a former tanning salon a few doors down from a donut shop and a nail emporium. Unlike the property managers we had encountered earlier in our quest, the one responsible for this location was a business-savvy Buddhist who felt a bookstore would lend class to his L-shaped strip mall, and to this end was willing to foot the bill to have the tile floors chipped out. The tanning beds were carted away, but the sign over the door stayed up for a ridiculously long time. Tan 2000. I went to Australia on yet another leg of book tour, leaving all the work on Karen's head. The word had spread to the Southern Hemisphere. In Australia, all anyone wanted to talk about was my bookstore. Journalists called from Germany and India wanting to talk about the bookstore. Every interview started off the same way. Hadn't I heard the news? Had no one thought to tell me? Bookstores were over. And then, one by one, the interviewers recounted the details of their own favorite stores. And I just listened. They told me, confidentially and off the record, that they thought I might just succeed. I was starting to understand the role the interviews would play in that success. In my 30s, I'd paid the rent by writing for fashion magazines. I found Elle to be the most baffling because the editors insisted on defining trends. Since most fashion magazines closed 3 months before they hit the newsstands, identifying fashion trends, especially from Nashville, required a near act of clairvoyance. Eventually, I realized what everyone in fashion already knew. A trend is whatever you call a trend. This spring in Paris, fashionistas will wear fish bowls on their heads. In my hotel room in Australia, this insight came back to me more as a vision than as a memory. The small independent bookstore is coming back, I told reporters in Berlin and Bangladesh. It's part of a trend. My act was on the road, and with every performance, I tweaked the script, hammering out the details as I proclaimed them to strangers. All things happen in cycles, I explained. The little bookstore succeeded and grew into a bigger bookstore. Seeing the potential for profit, the superstore chains rose up and crushed the independents. Then Amazon rose up and crushed the superstore chains. Now that we could order any book at any hour without having to leave the screen in front of us, we realized what we had lost, the community center, the human interaction, the recommendations of a smart reader rather than a computer algorithm telling us what other shoppers had purchased. I promised whoever was listening that from those very ashes, the little independent bookstore would rise again. Say it enough times and it will be true. Build it, and they will come. In Melbourne, I gave a reading with Jonathan Franzen. I asked him if he would come to my bookstore. Sure, he said. I'd like to do that. Down in the antipodes, my mind began to flip through my Rolodex. I know a lot of writers. Meanwhile, back in Nashville, Karen and Mary Gray had hired a staff, and together they washed the warehoused Borders bookshelves again and again while they waited for the paint to dry and the flooring to arrive. In a burst of optimism, we'd hoped to open on October 15th. Lights were still missing when we finally did open on November 15th. We had forgotten to get cash for the cash register, and I ran to the bank with my checkbook. That morning, the New York Times ran the story about the opening of Parnassus with a photo of me on page A1. Imagine a group of highly paid consultants crowded into the offices of my publishers, HarperCollins. Their job is to try to figure out how to get a picture of a literary novelist, me, say, on the front page of the New York Times. She could kill someone. One consultant suggests. The other consultants shake their head. It would have to be someone very famous. She could hijack a bus or maybe restructure the New York public school system. They sigh. It would not be enough. They run down a list of crimes and stunts and heroically good deeds, but none of them are page one material. I can promise you this. Kept in that room for all eternity, none of them would have landed the idea that opening a 2,500-square-foot bookstore in Nashville beside the Donut Den would do the trick. The bookstore that does in fact open in Nashville is so beautiful, I cannot even make sense of it. While I spent the summer talking, Karen has taken her dreams out of the air. She made the ideal bookstore of her own imagination into a place where you can actually come and buy books. I realize now that my business partner is something of a novelist herself. She attended to the most tedious details and then went on to make a work of art. Through every color choice, every cabinet, every twinkling hanging star, she had conjured a world that was worth inexpressibly more than the sum of its dazzling parts. The kind of bookstore small children will remember when they are old themselves. Parnassus, we could finally see, was perfectly named, as she had known all along that it would be. Every time I walk in the door, I think Karen is the one person that I met who wanted to open a bookstore, and how in the world was I smart enough to sign on for life? When we had our grand opening the following Saturday, an all-day extravaganza that stretched from early morning puppet shows to late-night wine and cheese, an estimated 3,000 Nashvillians came through the store, devouring the books like locusts sweeping through a field of summer wheat. All of us who worked there, a number I do not normally include myself in, but in this case I was with them, had waited so long for customers that once they finally came in, we could not stop telling them what we wanted them to read. I'm going to stop for a second. There's about a page more. That's a really, really important point, and I want to just hit it. There are so many things about opening this bookstore that I never took into account. I really thought that I was doing a good deed for the city. I really started off thinking, you know, it was like giving money to the symphony or something. This is just what we need, and I'm going to have to pony up and do it. And I didn't think about all of the amazing ways it's changed my life and has been nothing but a joy. And one of the biggest ways is that I can force you to buy the books that I love. And when you're a reader, this doesn't have anything to do with being a writer, because all of you know this, the joy of being a reader and of finding a book you love is to give it to somebody else and say, you have to read this. And I've been leaning on my family and my friends for my whole life, making them read the books that I love. And now I can walk into that store and just find any poor person who's like trying to locate the restroom and say, you have to read this. This is the book you want to read. That book you just walked by, go back. That's the book that you love. That's the book that needs you, that you need. And when I went out on tour before we opened for State of Wonder, I decided that I want to sort of hone and test my skills as a bookseller. So I found this fabulous little novel called The All of It by Jeanette Hain, and I had it put back in print, and I wrote an introduction, and I had every store that I went to on book tour order this book, and every night I sold it. And I sold it so well that it actually landed on bestseller lists, local bestseller lists, as I traveled around the country. And Jeanette Hain's been dead for a while, and it's still our number one best-selling book in the bookstore, and we keep a big stack of it, and anybody who's checking out, we say, so did you read all of it? Have you you haven't read it? You don't really have a choice. You have to buy it. And everybody, how many of you have read the All of It? I mean, God, yeah, and you come back and you get more of them, because it's just one of those books. So I really wanted to do that again this time. And I was in the market for another out-of-print book that I really, really loved. And the book that I found, which is available here tonight for purchase, is the very best book of essays I've ever read in my life. Now, you might think that it is a little wrong-headed to go out into America with your own book of essays and saying, well, if you want to save some money, this one's in paperback, and it is actually a lot better than my book. A Day at the Beach by Geoffrey Wolfe. A lot of people who know Geoffrey Wolfe either know him from his fantastic memoir, The Duke of Deception, or from the fact that he's Tobias Wolfe's brother. And when their parents got divorced, the father got Geoffrey and the mother got Toby, and they never saw each other until they were almost grown up. And how this book ever went out of print is such a mystery. But Geoffrey Wolfe lived, and he is alive, he lived such an interesting life. And when I read this book, what I realize is that most writers now, in fact, almost all writers now, lead really boring lives, unless they are paid to lead exciting lives. You know, unless they're John Krakauer, you know, they go off and they have an adventure because they have a contract to go and have an adventure. But Geoffrey is more adventuresome, smarter, a deeper thinker, and a better writer than just about anybody I know. So that's the other book I'm pushing. And then I also want to say a word about this. You know, this is so much better than being a writer. Being a bookseller is just so much better. I just really want to make you read. I love this book, and I have been saying everywhere, anytime I've been interviewed, this is the book that I've been talking about. I had absolutely nothing to do with it getting picked for Nashville Reads, and I couldn't be happier, because if I got to pick, this absolutely would be the book. And what the mayor said about the fact that you should just read it and have the experience with it, I agree wholeheartedly. It makes a lovely Christmas present, still in hardback. So nice under the tree. Oh, look, you got me the book that's going to be Nashville Reads. Thank you. If any of you saw Karen Joy Fowler at the Southern Festival of Books, so unbelievably funny. And she'll be here the beginning of April, and that's very exciting. Okay, I'm going to just polish this off. We just got like a page left. Hang on with me. One more joy I fail to consider, that we can talk strangers into reading the books that I love, just like I just did. The shelves we had so recently washed and dried and loaded down were startlingly empty. Karen kept running back to the office to order yet more books, while I kept climbing onto a bench to make yet another speech. Every local television news program came, every newspaper, along with People magazine. I was interviewed so many times, a person walking past the window of our bookstore on his or her way to the donut den might have thought that I had won the Derby, or cured cancer, or found a porthole to the South Pole. You know, I told Karen early on, you're going to wind up doing all the work, and I'm going to wind up getting all the credit, and that could be really annoying. But she didn't seem annoyed, either by the abstract concept or later by the omnipresent and unavoidable reality. You just do your job, she told me. I'll do mine. My job has become something I could never have imagined, and while surely it benefits Parnassus, Parnassus is not exactly the point. Without ever knowing that such a position existed, let alone that it might be available, I had inadvertently become the spokesperson for independent bookstores. People still want books. I've got the numbers to prove it. I imagine they remember bookstores of their youth with the same tenderness that I remember mine. They are lined up outside most mornings when we open the doors because, I think, they have learned through this journey that we've all been on that the lowest price is not necessarily the best value. Parnassus Books creates jobs in this community, and we contribute to the tax base. We've made a place to bring children to learn and to play and to think those two things are one and the same. We have a piano. We have store dogs. We have authors who come and read, and you can ask them questions, and they will sign your book. The business model may be antiquated, but it's the one that I like, and so far it's the one that's working. And maybe it's working because I'm an author, and maybe it's working because Karen works like life depends on this bookstore, or because we have a particularly brilliant staff, or because Nashville is a sympathetic city to all things independent. Maybe we just got lucky. But my luck has made me believe that changing the course of the corporate world is possible. Amazon does not get to make all the decisions. The people can make them by deciding where and how to spend their money. If what a bookstore offers matters to you, then shop at a bookstore. If you feel the experience of reading a book is a valuable one, then read a book. This is how we change the world. We grab hold of it. We change ourselves. Ah. Okay. Thank you. Now I'm going to come around because I'm wearing a really cute dress. And for the next 6 weeks, I'm going to be wearing like my prison jumpsuit, you know, my tights and clogs and little wool skirt night after night after night. So I thought this is the last time I'm going to look good until December 12th. That's it. Wanted to share that with you. Are there any questions? I can't imagine that you guys have anything. Oh, you do have something left to ask me. Oh, that's so nice. And good for you. She's going to buy the book from her own independent bookstore in Maine, as well you should. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a point that I always try to make. It's not that I think you should support my local independent bookstores. You should support your independent bookstores. I'm going to tell you something else, because it is really possible that there's nothing left to ask me. This book is called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, and there's a reason for that. There is a long essay in it about Carl and about how we got married and the history of marriage in my family, which is sort of spotty. but really, this is a book about commitment. This is a book, and I tried to organize it. I feel like so many times books of essays have two or three or four astonishingly great essays, and then the rest is like grocery lists and letters to the editors. They always feel sort of padded out. So I wanted to have a book that had a theme and had a sort of narrative arc, so it would read more like a novel. And this is a book about all of the things that I feel committed to, and that's bookselling and art and writing and my husband and my friends and my dog and my family, and that's sort of how it all goes together. And one of the things that I have really found in my life at this age, people really like to talk about creativity if you're a writer. You know, where's your muse? How do you get inspired? How do you feel it? You know, does the story come down on you in the middle of the night and you just start writing? Do you write on the back of cancel checks? You know what? You don't. I mean, I think that you do those things when you're 19 and you want to be a writer. But if you're actually making a living as a writer or making a living as a bookseller or anything else, you find out how to work, right? And creativity, to me, is a match. And work is spending your whole life in a warm house. You don't spend your life in a warm house because of a match. You spend your life in a warm house because you figure out how to split wood. And marriage is the same thing. You know, falling in love. It's like falling off a building. It's exciting. It's a great thing to do when you're 19. But if you want to stay married over the course of your life, what you figure out is that it's work. And that all of these things, for some reason in our society, we're so attracted to the love story and we're attracted to the tortured young artist. And we're not quite as interested in the people who make it and the fact that they make it through work. It's the difference between the first day you get a puppy, such a cute puppy, and like having a really old dog who's, you know, you love and you take care of and you have a relationship and you work it and you train each other and you figure out how to live together. So that's really what this book is about. I did a radio show today and they kept asking me about love, marriage, and I was like, read the whole book. Just read the whole book. It'll be fun. Other questions? What kind of dog do I have? Sparky. So actually somebody just said it in the audience. You can see Sparky at the bookstore much more often than you can see me at the bookstore. But we got Sparky at the Nashville Humane Association, and it was a great story. We had a terrific dog named Rose, who's in this book. Rose was 16. Rose died. It's the way of the world. I know. We all know. Terrible thing. So we waited a long time to get a new dog. Finally, this is the day we're going to go get a new dog. And we're going to go to the Humane Shelter, and we're going to go to the Metro Animal Control. We've got a whole list. And the first place we go is the Humane Shelter. And Carl and I walk in, and Carl says, "We want a small female dog." And the guy says, "We don't have any small female dogs." And Carl says, "Well, we want a small male dog." And the guy says, "Well, there's one in the first bin."
And so Carl goes over to the first bin, and Sparky is jumping up. And Carl reaches down, and he picks him up, and he says, okay, let's go. And I said, but we're going to go to three places, and we're going to, you know, like we talked about, we're going to assess and evaluate all available dogs in Nashville, and then we're going to look at our notes. And he said, no. And I said, shouldn't we at least just look at the other dogs that are here? And he's holding Sparky, and he says, you do whatever you need to do, and we'll wait here for you. And I said, no, that's fine. And we left. Best dog in the world. Never runs out the door. Children can pull his ears. He likes all people, all dogs. And he doesn't shed. Sparky. Thought about bringing him tonight. Yeah. Yes. The question was, if I start a book and I don't like it and I'm not connecting, do I put it down or do I feel like I owe it to the author? Come to my house sometime. Every single day of my life, someone sends me a book, usually more than one. And now that we've got the bookstore and everybody knows where I am, you can't even believe it. So the question is, how often do I actually stick it out and read the entire book? Because if something doesn't, I mean, if you don't have me from hello, you don't have me. And I have to put things down all the time. And I want to. I mean, it's just, there's so much to read and there's so many great books, and I don't want to read something that I don't love. I hate this word, I can barely say it. I have a blog at the bookstore on our website. I call it the book report, but once a month I write about the books that I'm reading and the books that I like, and I can't bring myself to write about books that I don't like. I will finish a book every now and then. I finished a book recently that I really disliked because it was by an author that I loved, and I had read all of her other books, and I wasn't going to miss this one, and I just couldn't stand it. But I can't bring myself to say that, you know, to write about a book that I don't like. Because I am completely convinced that I could be wrong, I could be having a bad day, it's just my opinion. A book that I really love might not be a book that you really, you know, we don't always line up. Now, I will say, at Parnassus, when I'm there, I will take books away from people. Not only will I give books to people, but if I see somebody walking by with a book that's not the right choice, I will pull it away from them. I recently saw somebody with the most recent Ian McEwan novel, and we struck up a conversation. You know, I wasn't hunting him down, but I was like, so what's up with you and that Ian McEwan novel? Do you really want that Ian McEwan novel? And he said, well, you know, my book club read Atonement. We absolutely loved it. We want to read another Ian McEwan novel. I said, but not that one. No. You want to read Enduring Love, a fantastic Ian McEwan novel. You do not want to read this. Once I saw a girl, and she had a copy of The Beautiful and the Damned. She was young. She was probably 20 years old. And I said, wow, The Beautiful and the Damned. Man, really? That's amazing. Like, you've read all of Fitzgerald, and you're just so dying for one more that you're willing to read The Beautiful and the Damned? She said, no, it's my first one. It's the only responsible thing to take it away from her. The only people who should read The Beautiful and the Damned are the people who are writing their thesis on Fitzgerald. She'd not read Gatsby. She said, well, my roommate told me this was the best one. I said, oh, honey, your roommate's wrong. So it's part of being a full-service bookseller, yes. Now the New Yorkers are gone. The question, I don't even get to look at the cartoons in the New Yorker anymore. Unless somebody calls me and says, you have to read this article, they just pile up and I send them to the office with Carl. How do I make time for reading in my life? It's just who I am. I mean, reading is such a huge part of the job. Reading is writing. Writing is reading. It's walking on two legs all the time. Those things are inseparable. My reading is very different now than it was before I had this bookstore, because, you know, I used to really love to read and reread Henry James. I was plowing my way through all of Dickens. I was reading back. I am such a current reader now. Two of my best friends who were here in the last 10 days, Donna Tartt and Liz Gilbert. Donna's book was 800 pages. Liz's book was 600, I think it was 700 when I read it in manuscript. Pat Conroy was here last week, and I interviewed him on stage. I had to read 2,000 pages of Pat Conroy just to catch up enough to do the interview. So a lot of my reading that I actually, of books that I make it through, is that kind of reading. And I, in a way, that's even better, because if I'm just reading on my own, I'll get into bed and read for an hour and go to sleep. But if Donna Tartt's coming, actually, she emailed me that book. Can you believe that? 800 pages. I printed it out. She gave it to me before the galley because I had a really bad cold, and it was about a week before the galley. And I said, Donna, I'm sick. I'm on the couch. This is it. You know, next week when you've got a galley, I'm going to be better, and I'm going to be off running. So I printed out the 800-page manuscript and sat there on the couch, and I read it in 2.5 days. I mean, my eyeballs were going to fall out of my head. I overstrained. But that is the best way to read a book, to just have a stack of paper and say, this is my priority, nothing else matters, and I'm going to give myself over to it and read. I just love that. But, yes. Have I inspired other people to open independent bookstores in other markets? I think I have, because there is an uptick. There's an uptick in everything, and I don't claim credit for it, but I think that I'm part of the puzzle, and a big part of it is me just walking around going, well, this is the trend. You know, this is there. It's all coming back. This is it. And bookstores, small bookstores, have been opening, and they have been successful. There's a writer named Lauren Groff who wrote two books, Monsters of Templeton and Arcadia. And I met her last year at the Southern Festival of Books, and she was living in Gainesville. And she said she really wanted to open a book. And I sent her this essay, which was just coming out in The Atlantic. And she emailed me, and she was like, oh, okay, now I understand. What I need to find is a Karen Hayes. And she said, and if I can't find one full-time Karen Hayes, I'll find two part-time Karen Hayeses. And I said, no, you're completely missing the point. There is no such thing as a part-time Karen Hayes. The very nature of Karen is that, you know, she's just going to get it done and take care of everything. So I do think that people are paying attention. I think that a lot of writers, what I'm always saying to writers is, if you're not going to open a bookstore, which of course most people can't, go to your bookstore and be more participatory. Sherman Alexie started a program called Small Business Saturday. So the Saturday after Thanksgiving, he's calling on all writers to go and work the day in their independent bookstore. So the Saturday after Thanksgiving, I will be home off a book tour, and I will be working in Parnassus. The Saturday after Thanksgiving, don't step on Sparky. Yes? Do I prefer writing fiction or essays? That's a really good question. The answer, I guess, is fiction. Fiction is so hard for me. So much harder. It's just, there's almost no connection in fiction and essays. Writing nonfiction is really easy. And the hardest essay I've ever written in my life isn't nearly as hard as the easiest chapter I've ever written in my life. So there's a way in which I would say, well, then I guess I would enjoy writing nonfiction more. But I feel like my higher calling, my greater purpose, is for fiction. And then I think, well, maybe that's stupid. Maybe I just feel that way because it's really hard for me. I don't know what the answer is. But I think that the balance between the two has been very nice. And at some point, you know, again, I hope I'm growing. I hope I'm changing. And maybe I'll write a book-length work of fiction. Now I'm getting so good at this, it's like I'm looking at my own watch. Yes, sir. It's an interesting point. It's that he's looking around and saying that 80, 90% of us are women, and that's true at the Southern Festival. Here's the thing. Women read fiction. Now, what does that do for me? I don't know. this is such an interesting book. I know how my novels are going to do. I read a novel. I can pretty much tell you how it's going to sell. Nonfiction is really tricky because, by and large, women don't read nonfiction. And by and large, men don't read fiction. And that's just kind of the way it is. There, obviously, there are the Dragon Tattoo books and the John Grisham books, and there are certain fiction that men read. But, you know, it's the same way that I think a lot of women don't read Lawrence in Arabia and the new Doris Kearns Goodwin and that sort of thing. No judgment, you know? We are where we are. I think that there are some women who feel offended that men don't read their fiction. It's always really interesting to me when I'm interviewed by a man who will say, oh, I had to read all of your books, and you're really good. Why do men not read you? I am not marketed in the chick lit department, for which I am forever grateful. But, you know, I'm not going to look down on my demographic and say, oh, I wish men read me. There's this notion that somehow it's more serious if men read you, or that men write about more serious issues, you know, like war instead of family. And I think, you know, we all do our own thing. We get our readers. I'm very honored that people read me. Liz Gilbert and I were talking a lot about this because her new book is a novel and it's gotten such wonderful reviews. And the reviewers have said, you know, well, maybe she'll get a more serious audience than the one that she had for Eat, Pray, Love, sort of dissing her Eat, Pray, Love readers. And she's like, you know, I love these women. These are my people. They have supported me. They heard my message. And I could never wish for a better group of readers than the one that I have. And that's sort of how I feel. So, yes. But I don't ever read them again. The question was how they compare, but I never can remember. Yes, and then we'll wrap it up. The question is about research and when I do it, and if I do it ahead of time. I don't do it ahead of time, and here's why. Research is really, really fun, and writing is a drag. And if you start to research something, you don't ever stop. You just keep thinking. I mean, if there's a lot about evolutionary biology in this book. So if I think, well, okay, I really need to read about evolutionary biology, right? You know, I need to read some Darwin. I need to. What you find if you don't know anything about evolutionary biology and you read something about it is that you don't know anything about it. And so you need to read another 10 books and another 10 books. So what I do is I write it wrong, and then I use research to correct myself. So I did go to the Amazon, and I went back, I corrected things. I was in the middle of the book when I went, but I also added things that I hadn't known before. My favorite example of that is that that book is full of cesarean sections. There are 3 cesareans in that book. Talk about a selling point. Oh, wow. I want to go out and read State of Wonder. So after I had finished and I had gone online and I had read about cesareans and I had asked, you know, I'm married to a doctor, you know, I'd ask people. But I have a friend who's an OBGYN, and I had asked her if I could go and watch a surgery. And she said, you know, we don't really do that anymore. That was kind of 1970s. And I said, well, if you have a patient who seems particularly nice and open-minded and wouldn't mind a novelist coming along. So she called me one day, and she said, come tomorrow morning. You're going to get to see a section. And at that point, I was probably in the last 2 weeks of the book, but I had certainly written all of the grisly surgical scenes. And I went, I scrubbed in, and I stood right next to my friend, and she said, you know, put your hands on the woman's thigh, just stand here. And every now and then she would take my hand and say, you know, do you feel that? That's the baby's head. Do you feel that? That's her kidney. And I was like, many, many, many things happened before I passed out. That, and I'm not joking either. And I have such a high tolerance for all of that. But I did. I learned all sorts of amazing things. You know, like in my scene, the surgeon is making these beautiful stitches, and I say something about it's like she's sewing up a quilt. And my friend was taking the skin like this, and, you know, I had something that looked like postal twine and a carpet needle. And I said, I actually said to her, couldn't you be a little neater about that? And she said, we call it gross surgery for a reason. Cesarean sections, don't recommend them. Okay, I feel like I should answer one more question because I don't really want to end on that note. Yes. Oh, hi, Monty. How are you? Did I learn anything by getting old and writing essays? We went to high school together, so she can ask me that. Yes. What I said about work. I mean, that is really what I've learned. You know, we're all so obsessed with winning the lottery. Oh, I just bought the best record, which shows you just that word, how old I am. Brandy Clark. I have no interest in country music. No interest in country music. This is the best record. And it's very country in its stories. And but she has this song on it called Pray to Jesus. And it's, we pray to Jesus and we play the lotto because those are the only two ways that we have to change our lives. And I think that, you know, we're so attracted to the sudden hit, the piece of good fortune that will instantly change everything. The falling in love, the love at first sight, the, you know, my whole world is turned upside down. I want no part of it. I think that what we get from work, what we get from a lifetime of exploring our own capabilities and difficulties and sticking with something and someone day in and day out, that's love, that's depth, that's so much better than Powerball. That's so much better than anything that's going to just come in and change your life. And I think that's what I've learned from writing and what I've learned from getting older. And it's beautiful, you know, life is beautiful and short. and we get out exactly what we put in. I'm going to say one more thing, and then it'll take us all the way back to the beginning and my relationship with Nikki Castle and the whole notion of karma, which is a word that, you know, has all these kind of groovy New Age connotations. But karma is action. You know, it's you do something, you smoke cigarettes for 30 years, and then you quit for 20 years, and you wind up getting lung cancer anyway. That's karma. You know, you're sorry, you wish you hadn't done it, but you did. And it sticks around. What we do, good and bad, stays with us in the world. And the fact that Nikki was the babysitter for my sister's kids when she was in college in 2003, when she was a sophomore, and my whole family fell in love with her, and we stuck by her, and she stuck by us. She helped our family. We helped her. I got her a job in New York at my agency. I brought her back here. You know, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm bringing you back to Nashville. I'm doing so much for you. But then she goes into my closet and goes through my papers, and she starts doing these things, and I have a book that is 100% because of her, because of that loving relationship and that work and that long period of time of sticking by somebody who's giving to you, who's needing you. Life is good. Thank you.